Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Crab Dystopia edition. That is a really bad David Attenborough.
I didn't even realize that's what that was.
nor should you have. On today's show, Get Out is the debut film from Jordan Peele of Key and Peele fame. He wrote and directed this horror comedy about the black boyfriend of a white girlfriend discovering the sinister truth of her seemingly racially enlightened family. And then the lights, the stars, the dresses, the wins, the losses, and of course, capital T, capital F, the flub we have to do at the Oscars. And finally, Planet Earth, the glorious high-def opus about our common mama and the biodiversity she supports, returns. It's on BBC America, and you can stream new episodes on Amazon and iTunes. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Dana Stevens, Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steven.
Julia, before we dig in, no doubt we have some business.
Yes, several pieces of business. Number one, we are coming to Washington, D.C. to do a live show on April 19th, and tickets are available for that live show at slate.com/live. Please come out and see our show. We would be so delighted to see you. Number two, next week's show is when we are discussing 1984. So if you have been wending your way through it or meaning to pick it up, you have another week to do so if you want to hear our discussion unspoilt or newly refreshed with 1984 in your mind. And finally, our Slate Plus segment this week, available to Slate Plus members, is going to be a spoiler-rich appreciation of Get Out. We're talking about the movie in a regular segment, but the movie is so rich with interesting details, we thought it would be fun to stick around and dissect the ending and all of the little secrety bits we wouldn't be able to discuss in a normal segment. So if you are not yet a member of Slate Plus, now is a great time to join. When you do, you get access to an ad-free version of our podcast feed, bonus segments every week, and you support Slate and the journalism that we do. You can join at slate.com/cultureplus. All right, let's commence.
Get Out is the debut film from Jordan Peele, best known for the cunningly not post-racial comedy show Key and Peele. He wrote and directed this, his first feature film. It tells the story of a young black man played by Daniel Kaluuya, who is dating a young white woman played by Allison Williams, who goes to meet her parents for the weekend. What follows is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, meets Meet the Parents, meets Rosemary's Baby, meets the Stepford Wives, but truthfully, it's too original for me to put it this way. Get Out is, I have to say, it's a stunningly confident and strange debut film. I loved it. Can't wait to hear what you guys thought of it. But first, let's listen to a clip.
Yeah, and the clip we're about to hear is the scene where Chris meets the parents of Rose, the Allison Williams character, and they are played by Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? How long?
4 months.
4 months.
Mm. 5 months, actually.
She's right. I'm wrong.
Attaboy. Better get used to saying that.
Please. I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. She's right. I'm wrong. See?
Does he have an off button? This is exhausting.
I know. And I want to give you a tour.
Unpack first?
You want to unpack? Before the tour?
All right, well, we're joined by Aisha Harris, who's a Slate culture writer and host of the Slate podcast Represent. Aisha, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm excited to talk about this movie. Very.
I'm so excited to have you here to talk about it. I mean, I scarcely even know where to begin asking you questions about it. But just tell me what you thought of it. But what a remarkable debut. I mean, how many chainsaws can you throw in the air and juggle beautifully, having never directed a feature length film before? What a movie.
Well, I mean, what's great about it is I think, well, Jordan Peele, in an interview that I can't recall where it's from now, but he said, you know, while talking about this film, that Key and Peele was like a directing 300 different short films. And it's kind of accurate. Like, if you watch any of his sketches from Key and Peele, which aired on Comedy Central for 5 seasons, there's so many different shorts that sort of mirror what we see in feature length form and with Get Out. They've frequently parodied the horror movie genre and also use the horror movie genre to critique race. And I think what Peele is doing here with Get Out is just like expanding on those ideas in a way that's like even more, even sharper and even more astute and even scarier. Mm-hmm. And I just think I went into this movie. I'm a huge Key and Peele fan. I went into it with very high expectations, but expecting in a way to be disappointed. And I came out thinking like, this is a movie we are going to be talking about for years to come. And
yeah,
if I was in film school, this is probably going to be on like college syllabi for years to come.
Well, you know, I walked into it thinking, especially because Keanu got this criticism a lot, the movie that was not directed by but written by Key and Peele, that was their first kind of cinematic endeavor. The main criticism I remember hearing of Key and Peele, which is a very common criticism of TV comics in their first movie, is that it was a bunch of sketches put together, right? That it lacked kind of structure and cohesion. And you could never say that about Get Out. I mean, mm-hmm. It has this fable-like tautness to it. It's I think an hour and 40 minutes long, but it feels almost like an hour-long episode of The Twilight Zone or something like that. It's extremely compact in its construction.
And everything in it is purposeful. I mean, I hate rewatching things. Like, no matter how much I love something, I almost never want to see it a second
time. I didn't
know that. Don't like rewatching things at all. Like, I feel like I've got limited watching hours. I want to see something new. But I'm dying to go back and see this because in the days since I saw it, every conversation I've had about it, every passing thought about it has elicited in me this little like aha moment, either an appreciation of some clue that was embedded earlier in the film or a deeper understanding of some scene and what it really meant. You know, I think for those of you who want to be completely unspoiled, you can skip this segment and go see the movie. And there might be some delights to that. Like if you haven't seen the trailer and you think you want to see the movie, maybe just skip the segment and come back. The trailer level reveal is, you know, black boyfriend, white girlfriend. She like hasn't revealed to her parents that her boyfriend is black before bringing him home for the weekend.
But it's totally fine because they're so
but it's totally fine. They're not racist. They're nice liberal parents. They're going to be a little awkward and daddish, but they're going to be fine. And then in the trailer, you see that like the household servants in the house, A, the house has household servants. B, those servants are black. C, they act super weird and like dead-eyed and seem very like strange and Stepford-y. And then, you know, in the trailer, you see there's a garden party with one black guest. And at some point, the black guest seems to crack and be like, get out. And voila, that is the name of the movie. So you have the sense that all is not right at Catherine Keener's house.
Oh, so I love the movie. It's incredible. It clears however high you want to set the bar. It's almost surely going to clear it. Among the things that I really loved about it, Aisha, is that a successful horror movie, I think, builds on, they all really have to build on a pre-existing anxiety. Rosemary's Baby might be the classic example. You know, there's a degree of anxiety about having a child that movie just, you know, gets at from the inside, but then explodes completely. This is about meeting a new boyfriend or girlfriend's parents, to which obviously is added this other dimension, the racial dimension. I talk a little bit about how with that anxiety played completely straight and naturalistically, out of that comes the horror movie.
We talk about the meet the parents aspect and adding the racial lens to that. But the movie actually opens by playing on a different pre-existing anxiety, which is essentially being a black person walking around in a neighborhood that is not their own and in which there are presumably mostly white people, and that fear that it plays off of. And it opens with a character played by Lakeith Stanfield. He's walking around. He doesn't know where he is. It's nighttime. He's in a suburb. And as soon as this white car starts to creep up alongside him, he's like, nope, not today, and starts to turn around. And that plays into the pre-existing fear, I think, that we all now have, especially in the wake of Trayvon Martin, and the way in which that very directly sort of mirrors what happened that night, where he was walking around in a Florida suburb in a gated community and was attacked. And the same thing happens to him. And so the way in which the movie kind of opens that up and just layers more of that on top with each scene that comes afterwards, I think is just really brilliant and is a great example of the way in which Get Out uses these horror movie tropes, but then subverts them through a racial lens, which we haven't always seen. Like, we don't usually see that.
Well, the other thing that it does really remarkably is set on two sets of racial anxieties at once, right? So the racial anxiety of Black people, that they're going to be, the violence will be inflicted upon them at any moment for no reason, which, you know, is eternal and longstanding, but has become like part of national news and conversation in the wake of Trayvon Martin and Ferguson and other incidents over the last 5 years or so. And then the white anxiety about how racist you are and sort of the general challenging of the notion that, like, that sense that, you know, being like a well-meaning white liberal is just like a fine way to exist in the world, this movie challenges also in a really amazing way. So what starts as Bradley Whitford seeming like an cringeworthy dad turns into this whole family being a bunch of nefarious weirdos. And the tension in the movie is that the Chris character has heightened anxiety compared to everyone around him because of his life experience of, you know, being reasonably anxious about the fate that might befall him as a Black man at any turn. And his, like, turned up anxiety is then deployed against this family, which seems sort of bucolic and innocent at first and then just super fucking weird as the movie goes on. And the simultaneous ratcheting of those two anxieties is played so beautifully. It's just like a marvel to behold.
I would just add that tension is diffused really nicely and in a really comic way by this character played by Lil Rel Howery, who plays Rod, the best friend of Chris, who is taking care of Chris's dog while he's away at his girlfriend's parents' house. And they have these phone calls in which essentially the friend, the Rod character, plays the part of the audience who's saying to a horror movie character, "Don't go in that room.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man? Look, they could have made you do all types of stupid shit. They have you fucking barking like a dog. Looking ridiculous, okay? Or, I don't know if you know this, white people love making people sex slaves and shit."
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're not a kinky sex family, dog.
Yeah, I think that what makes Rod such a great character is the way in which he serves as the sort of the voice in Chris's head about what he should be worried about. You're constantly being told as a Black person that your anxieties and your fears are not valid or they're not real and they're all in your head. And the way in which, like, you know, I don't think it's spoiling anything because we know that this is, like, it's not all in his head. And Rod, to some extent, is correct.
It's such a movie for our time because it is really about, in a way, I mean, the sort of racial truth that it reveals is, wait, things really are as bad as you think they might be. You know, they're worse. They're much worse. And even though it's played on a comic level, it, in fact, is a very politically astute movie.
Well, and Peele has talked about the idea that that the initial conceit of the movie, which was very much developed during the Obama administration, was just the lie of post-racial America. Like, the notion that, okay, we elected Obama, so everything's fine now, is obviously not true, as the news of the last 5 years and particularly the last 6 months have shown. And, you know, that in some ways, a couple people have asked him, like, oh, is it weird for this movie to come out in Trump's America versus Obama's? But it feels even more pertinent in a way because it challenges the idea that, like, you know, the racism that's left is the obvious kind, like people getting shot in the back and that getting captured on video, or, you know, some other people somewhere else who are racist and bad.
Which is also, I think Peele said this in an interview, why he set this movie in a sort of vague, it's not really said where it is, right? But it's like a vaguely East Coast-y, it feels like an East Coast liberal suburb. The movie was actually shot in Alabama, so it could easily have been set in Alabama, but he deliberately did not want to make it a red state situation.
Well, and it reads as high WASP, like as I guess with Steve on the call, I can't really be our resident WASP, but like it reads as high WASP. Like Allison Williams, I loved your line in your review of the movie for us about, what did you call her?
Oh, the basic Becky, queen of the basic
Ultimate basic Becky.
Yeah, basically. Yes, she's basically the basic Becky, our foremost basic Becky of the millennial generation.
Perfect casting of her in that part.
And yeah. Becky being, I mean, just give a little of the etymology of Becky, you know, which predates Lemonade, right?
But I mean, Becky's just your typical white girl. I don't really know
it's
how
like
else
clueless
to.
Clueless white girl.
Yeah, she likes, yeah, she, you know, she likes Starbucks and black men. I don't know. I guess that's like one way to put it.
She's wearing Uggs with no socks.
She is like contemplating donuts, not at a Starbucks, but possibly at a Starbucks in the opening scene of the movie. I have to say, I think she's amazing in this movie,
she's
too.
Yeah,
like
great.
It plays against her image so narrowly, and she is so smart in the role.
You know, because we've been talking so much about the content and the casting and stuff, I wanted to just throw out a quick word of praise for the look of this movie and the style of it. I mean, one thing that Key and Peele didn't get to do as much as in Key and Peele, although they are great at creating sort of little mini visual worlds in their sketches, they didn't really get to explore dream spaces and kind of interior psychological spaces as much. And the moments in which the Chris character undergoes hypnosis, which is pictured in this kind of absurdist way where Catherine Keener, who's a psychiatrist, stirs her tea hypnotically and somehow the clinking of the spoon puts him into this spell. And at that moment, the movie goes into this world. What I wrote down in my notes was under the skin, you know, those scenes mm-hmm. in Under the Skin totally. Where the real world becomes this sort of floating black space. And that's sort of the space that he's falling into. And you see whoever is hypnotizing him or whoever is sort of hovering over him at that moment in this kind of rectangular screen that's slowly receding into the interior of the image. And it's just, it's very eerie and beautiful and a really interesting visual choice to make in a movie that could easily just be shot like a sitcom. I will say that my set of questions about this movie have to do with the very ending, which I know we're going to talk about in our spoiler segment. And I'm glad, Aisha, that you're sticking around for that, because there are a couple of things that I'm not sure I understood about the movie's last 5 minutes or so. But that's not a critique. It's just a reason to see the movie again for me.
Terrific. Okay, well, the movie is Get Out from Jordan Peele, written and directed by him. It is kind of an astonishing debut feature. We all loved it. Four thumbs way, way up. The politics and racial politics of it are as complex as the movie is divertingly weird. So please come to facebook.com/culturefest and tell us what you thought of it. All right, moving on. All right, well, moving on. Aisha, thanks for sticking around to talk about the Oscars. I hardly have a formal introduction for this. I do wonder though, whether for how astonishing it was in the moment and how picked over it's been since, if the flub isn't the least important thing that happened at the Oscars, sort of the gist of what you wrote.
Yeah, no, my biggest concern when in the moment when it happened, or maybe after, because at first I was like, yay, was, is this going to overshadow the fact that Moonlight won? And I think to some extent it did, because everyone now seems to be talking about the way in which the producer Jordan Horowitz of La La Land graciously and ever so heroically gave the award to Moonlight after thinking he had won.
There was that one outrageous Boston Globe column that claimed he's the hero of a generation.
There were a couple Boston Globe, the Washington Post called him the truth teller we need in these times.
It's like, bar for manners has gotten very low. So, I mean, he was composed in a confusing moment.
Yes.
Fine.
He did exactly what any decent human being should do. But yes, Moonlight, the fact that it won, even if it was sort of robbed of the moment that it should have had, which is hearing its name announced without having to deal with the La La Land producers already being up there, it's just astonishing, because this movie, it was made for $1.5 million. It's the first movie that A24 has both produced and distributed before they were just distributors. And it's a movie about a black gay boy. And we've never seen an LGBTQ movie win for Best Picture. And we've also never seen I guess In the Heat of the Night is the exception. But we've never seen we've never seen a movie with black characters that is not based on like a historical moment or whatever. It's set in contemporary times. It's not explicitly about racism. And so for it to win Best Picture is just such a monumental feat that should completely overshadow the way in which it was announced that it won.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, the unusualness of the win, there's no question that it would have been a much more of a gasping, breathtaking moment for it to win because of all those reasons you said, because it has an all-black cast. I mean, you say that it's not about racism. I mean, there's not even a white person in the movie, barely even in the background.
You're right.
I mean, there's another reason this is extraordinary, right? I mean, it was not expected to win. La La Land was supposed to kind of cakewalk its way to, you know, possibly as many as 8 or 10 awards. And furthermore, it's the remarkable moment where what really arguably is the best, most beautiful, most daring, most true movie of the year won Best Picture.
Yeah, I saw lots of people saying that on social media afterward. It's a movie that cinephiles love. You know, it's a movie that, although more people are going to see it now, not that many people have seen it, but audiences responded to it really strongly too. And I remember in Movie Club when we were writing and talking about this movie, just saying that to me, one of the most uplifting things of the movie year was that this movie that had a completely black cast that was made for a low budget had the success it did, even in the limited release that it had. But it has made a lot less money than La La Land. And so this will also be great for the business fortunes of the movie.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't really thought about the towering achievement of just the movie that was believed by most people who love cinema to be the best movie winning is its own achievement separate from the race and sexuality of the people featured in the film. I hear you. I think Aisha's post about this was very smart. I think in some ways it would have been more glorious for Moonlight to just win and for Barry Jenkins to have his moment. On the other hand, what a fucking great moment in an Oscars telecast. And like, it won't really, like, actually, when people look back at the list of Oscar winners, they won't necessarily all remember which was the year that it happened for. And nothing interesting ever happens at the Oscars. And I am pro gaffe. Like, that was a crazy, compelling, insane moment. It gave you the feeling that something exciting could happen. And, you know, I do really, it seems like the La La Land and Moonlight folks have really been on the award circuit for the last 3 months together and do genuinely respect each other's movies and know each other as people, and that the sort of humanity of the La La Land folks in seating the stage and the graciousness of Barry Jenkins in acknowledging their work in his remarks. I mean, certainly there's a case for he shouldn't have to acknowledge anybody else's work in his remarks about his amazing movie that won and the historical moment. But on the theory of the Oscars are boring and it's better when they're interesting, what a glorious Oscar moment.
Well, I also have to say that I liked how that moment subverted this narrative that grew up during the Oscar race in which La La Land, which, as you guys know, I really like. I'm glad it didn't win Best Picture, but I really like the movie. That it sort of got cast as Trump in a way. You know, it sort of became, it somehow became, you know, symbolic of white supremacy or something like that. And certainly if it had swept the Oscars, which it seemed at one point like it was going to do, and after, you know, in those 25 seconds after the Best Picture announcement before the correction, that, you know, even as a big fan of La La Land, I had this feeling of like, oh, crap. You know, I mean, that's just not, it's not a, for the outcome of the year in which we elect a white supremacist president of the United States, it's just not a good look for that to have swept the whole awards. So I completely understand that sort of symbolic pitting of the two movies against each other. But I really appreciate that the actual makers, crews, and cast of those two movies didn't seem to play it in that way or to encourage the public to play it in that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was trying to think the rest of that night, like a lot of people, I think I stayed up late that night because I was just wired after the Oscars. It was such a funny moment. It was such a weird moment. It was kind of fun to watch the story unroll bit by bit about how PricewaterhouseCoopers screwed the whole thing up. And there's a really good, we can link to it on our show page, there's a really good kind of TikTok of it in The Hollywood Reporter where essentially all the facts that are known about exactly how the wrong envelope got into Warren Beatty's hands are reported. And it's really interesting. But I think that some of the catharsis of that moment, the moment of surprise and the moment of Jordan Horowitz holding up the envelope and saying, no, it's you guys, it's Moonlight, that in some way, even though I just went on this big speech saying, let's not equate, you know, La La Land with white supremacy, but it was just a moment in which a decision that seemed to be somehow cosmically wrong was suddenly cosmically righted. And, you know, just somehow as a symbolic catharsis that was meaningful, I think.
It reminded me of when the Cubs came back from like obscurity out of nowhere in the last, what was it, 12th inning?
It's at some point we're going to go back to having boring conclusions to national events. and maybe in the case of elections, we should want that. But in the case of everything else, there shouldn't have been a lot of surprise endings lately. This so overshadows anything else about the night, and it's been so hashed over at this point, maybe we don't need to go too much further. But I actually thought the night was sort of less explicitly political than I thought generally in terms of the speeches. It sort of seemed like everyone was waiting for everyone else to give their big you know, powerful political speech. And the sort of most explicit one was the speech that was read for Asghar Farhadi, the Iranian director, who opted not to come in solidarity with other people from his country who can no longer freely enter the United States. And there were a few other explicit notes, but really the awards seemed like a more implicit rebuke to Trumpism in that there were more Black winners than at any other ceremony ever. Lots of foreign people won awards. In who the awards went to, it felt like there was an embrace of internationalism and multiculturalism and sort of anti-Trump ethos, but there were a lot less celebrity soapbox moments than I thought.
It's hard to know whether that definitely seems true of the way the evening was presented and also just the choices that the Academy made. And I wonder how much of that is because of the reforms that they made after Oscars So White to diversify, and how much of it just had to do with people reacting to the year in politics. I mean, I have to say that one really painful moment for me that I think the producers could have easily avoided was, why did they have Brie Larson present the award for Best Actor, knowing that Casey Affleck was one of the favorites to win the award, right? I mean,
that's the way it goes, right? Like, the person who won Best Actress the year before presents...
Always presents Best Actress?
Yeah. At least for the last, like, decade.
Dana, how do you not know that? You know me and the Oscars are like oil and water. I never noticed that. I mean, I know that former winners come up and present awards, but I didn't know that you were locked into a certain category.
For Best Actor and Best Actress...
And supporting.
Yeah. It's always you come back whoever after won, you won the last year. Now, granted, they could have, you know... I think if she felt like she could... She's in a difficult position. She can't say, like, I don't want to do it, but she could say, I don't want to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, in last year's Oscars, after she won for Room, right, they had this moment when a bunch of sexual assault survivors
came on
stage.
That was during Lady Gaga's performance.
Right.
Song.
And yeah. Do you remember that Brie individually hugged each one? And
right.
If you follow her on Twitter, too, you just see that she's a, you know, very committed activist, and maybe because of that movie, one of her big issues is sexual assault and abuse. And so to see her have to present that award to Casey Affleck, which, if you know, she did not applaud him. She did not smile when she read out the envelope.
Him.
Yeah,
anyways,
just for clarity, he's been accused of sexual assault. Yeah, no, that was an awkward moment. To move along to equally important topics, I also just didn't care about any of the dresses.
Janelle Monáe looked amazing.
Oh, she looked good.
She was wearing like this futuristic looking black sparkly. There are lots of.
Oh, like, it was so great with kind of like mesh fishnet shoulders and a strange gold headband. She was kind of this combination of steampunk and outer space or something. Mm-hmm. And she looks great in everything. I mean, she's just such a great clothes wearer.
Yeah. Any other dress highlights before we wrap it up?
Amy Adams looked pretty knockout. I mean, a lot of people had that really, really deep plunging neckline, which seems to be the new thing, is just basically having your knockers half exposed.
The contoured boobs.
But she looked amazing, and I wanted her to look amazing because she really did get dissed by not being nominated for a rival, right? I mean, even if it was just a filler nomination and she wasn't going to win, if you're going to recognize that movie with 7 nominations, at least put the star who carries the entire movie in the list.
Mm-hmm. Steve, who had your favorite look? All right, we can move on.
All right. Justice most served, the Moonlight win, most egregious win, least deserving, like, how did it go? How did this award go to this person?
You know, I basically after his speech, I would say Casey Affleck. I hated Casey Affleck's speech so much. Coming on top of all these, you know, these accusations against him. Granted, like none of this has been actually pursued in court yet. But I mean, I love Manchester by the Sea. He's incredible in it. I've never had much of a feeling about him as an actor before. But after this movie, I do really think he has chops as an actor. But just him shambling up there, first of all, looking like he has crumbs in his bed, basically, as was joked at, I believe, the Independent Spirit Awards. I'm not sure if the joke was about him, but somebody was accused as looking as if they have crumbs in their bed. So he comes up looking like he's got crumbs in his bed and then proceeds to make this really rambling, self-centered speech. I was very turned off by him after that.
I actually was running to get a glass of water and didn't see his speech, which may affect how I feel about it. His performance was amazing. Like, those charges are very troubling. They have not been proved. Like, I thought his performance was better than Denzel's in Fences. I'm sorry. Like, Fences is not the greatest movie ever. And
Denzel
is incredible. And if Denzel had never won anything ever before, you know, like, he deserves all the acting accolades that he has gotten. But, like, that was a theater performance on the screen, and it was didn't quite land. And so much of the character in Manchester by the Sea, which was amazing, was established through the physicality of Casey Affleck. Like, I don't like, to me, I think the Zootopia, like Zootopia winning Best Animated over Moana is my most egregious. Like, Zootopia was fine and fun, and we talked about it, but Sam Adams wrote a great post for us calling Zootopia the crash of animated movies, in that, like, it is about race, but the way in which it is about race is completely fucked up. Like, it sort of has the idea of having a harmonious modern lesson about racial profiling, but actually what it assumes underneath is, like, in applying it to predators and prey, it actually then does assert that there is a deep physiological difference and power imbalance between types of people/creature. Anyway, it's fucked up. So that I would object more to that than to the victory for Casey.
Yeah, in fact, I have a more egregious one than that, because going in, I was not rooting for anyone in particular for Best Actor. I agree that Casey Affleck's incredible. So in a sense, yes, he deserved the award. It was the combination of his crassness in his speech and his lack of preparation, and then Denzel crying in the audience, and not a crying of, like, I'm just so moved to be here. It was a crying of, like, this fucking sucks.
Well, also the fact that Casey Affleck, for at least the second time, dragged Denzel into his speech, because he did that at the Golden Globes too, and was like, Denzel... And he just, like, doesn't really say anything. He's just like, Denzel. It's like, yeah, no, that award should be Denzel's. I'm sorry, I disagree. Love is a strong word. I really liked Manchester by the Sea, and I thought Casey Affleck's great. I thought every piece of it is great. I do think Denzel, you can say it's theatrical. I think he was giving one of the best performances he's ever given.
And he directed the movie, and he put it up on stage in order to direct it, and it's just been such a life's work for him. So, I mean, I'm not going to say that I was sitting there rooting for Denzel, but the way things fell out, that kind of sucked. But Steve, my one egregious one is going to be Silence, the movie we talked about last week, which I think deserved the cinematography award. That was the only thing it was up for. And La La Land ended up taking the cinematography award. Fine, I love La La Land. It's gotten lots of recognition, but that was a moment when I just thought, come on, let's give this guy some recognition.
I think the most offensive thing was the fact that Emma Stone won for Best Actress. She was good, but to me that was not a groundbreaking performance. It didn't reveal anything new to me about her as a performer, as an actress.
Well, that's just the whole Oscars love ingenues thing, right?
I mean,
Gwyneth Paltrow had to do for a few years there was blow her nose and she would get an Oscar.
Right. So,
well, and coming after Brie Larson winning last year, who is similarly, like, of ingenue age, but who gave a performance that was, like,
devastating.
Truly extraordinary. I mean, whatever. I've, like, issued enough La La shade on this show, but I agree. That wasn't my fave.
Okay, well, you're all wrong, because the most egregious was Justin Hurwitz winning for Best Score for La La Land. It should have gone to Nick Britton.
Oh, fuck. I can't believe I didn't say that.
Oh, sandbag. All right. Well, if ever there was a time to call out to listeners to come on to our Facebook page and give us grief, this would be it. Facebook.com/CultureFest. Aisha, thank you so much for joining us for 3 segments. What a pleasure.
Thank you. It was fun.
We should also mention, of course, that Aisha's terrific podcast, Represent, has had multiple episodes this week, one about the Oscars and another about Get Out. So you should tune in to her show to hear more about the things we discussed. Thanks, Aisha.
Thank you.
The follow-up to the 11-part series Planet Earth is here, and it's only more of the magnum-y and opus-y same. Maybe not quite as magnum-y at 6 episodes instead of 11, but never fear. The show's narrated, of course, by the great old icon himself, David Attenborough. Looking down from 2 miles above the surface of the earth, it is impossible not to be impressed by the sheer grandeur. Such a terrible impression. sheer grandeur, splendor. It's more of the wonderful same. It takes a series of tight shots of animals interacting in the wild and edits them into slightly moralistic vignettes. Nevertheless, who cares? The earth is magnificent, and so is this. Why don't we listen to a clip?
For millions of years, this remote speck of land has been ruled by crabs. Their ancestors came from the sea, but most have now adopted a land-based existence. Given there are so many of them, they get along relatively harmoniously. They're the gardeners and caretakers of a tiny crab utopia. Once a year, they must all return to the sea to breed, and the March of the Red Crabs is one of the greatest natural spectacles on Earth. There are 50 million of them.
All right, well, Dana, I have to start with you. You love this show. Tell us why.
I do. I love Planet Earth. I love David Attenborough. I know I foresee all of the criticisms that will be made of this series and read a few of them as well, that it's not sort of sufficiently dire in its tone of alarm about the destruction of our planet, which we can talk about in a moment, that it anthropomorphizes the animals too much. That's probably true, but one of the more charming elements of the show as well. And part of what I think makes it so appealing to children while being, you know, not talking down to them or being made for children in any way. What else is it accused of? Maybe of editing, you know, as documentaries always do, of editing footage together in a way that creates stories that might not have been there in the natural world. For example, there are moments when they're following these penguins. They're called chinstrap penguins. I think they're on the Galapagos somewhere.
No, they're in... they're in like a volcanic island in the dark,
right?
In the Arctic Sea, Antarctic Sea,
a pretty new island.
It's called like Saraguina or something. That's not it,
right?
Something like that.
I can't remember the place name, but it's basically a volcano with 1.5 million penguins living on it. It's utterly insane. Beautiful part of the show. But there's this moment that they follow the journey of this one father chinstrap penguin out to get fish for his family, and then coming back through these dangerous waves and climbing up these rocks. And I kept thinking as I was watching it, this is an incredible story that's being constructed, but it can't possibly be that they followed one penguin. They must once in a while have used another identical penguin doing the behavior that they wanted to get the father doing in order to construct this story. And so all of that stuff is sort of, you know, behind the scenes and all, I guess, valid critiques that can be made. But all I can say is that the object that's laid before you when you watch Planet Earth is this incredibly lushly shot and a beautifully narrated kind of Valentine to the planet. And my ecological argument for it would be not that, you know, it's something that Scott Pruitt should sit down and watch so that he understands the threat the planet is under. That would be maybe an inconvenient truth or just reading the news, the science news. But what this is more a way to make you fall in love with the planet. I think part of why my daughter is such a fiercely committed environmentalist is that she grew up watching Planet Earth and just seeing what an amazing, amazing place it is that we live. We don't need to travel to another planet. We have aliens right here. The Komodo dragons portion in that island section. It's like no monster movie, no kaiju, you know, fantasy could be more incredible than 2 3-meter-long Komodo dragons fighting over a piece of carrion.
I like that you've switched to the metric system for this segment, Dana.
Meters.
I had never seen any of them. I'd never watched any of the first ones for some reason. I don't know what I was doing 10 years ago that I was not watching them, but I just never... I think I was living in an apartment with no TV, actually. But I never saw them and sort of had them bookmarked. It's like, at some point I should look at that. But I'm such a sucker for, you know, narrative and plots that I assumed that I didn't... It seems sort of like a stoner... pastime to watch Planet Earth as an adult.
That's the reputation it got. Although, you know, you can save money on drugs because you sort of feel stoned just watching it.
Yeah, well, so watching it for the first time in preparation for the segment, I was astonished by how beautiful and mesmerizing they are to look at, how incredibly action-packed they are, like the rhythm that you think of, or at least that I've thought of in my head for nature documentaries of like twitching grass, cheetah lying in wait, blah, 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 boring for like 45 minutes and then action. It's just like all action sequences. Like you kind of get only the nature doc money shots and like none of the waiting around stuff. But all of the thoughts that it caused me to have are stoner thoughts. So I was not stoned while watching it, but all of the thoughts I have to share with you and our readers are like,
that's what I'm saying.
Whoa,
it's instant
the earth is so amazing. And like, oh, conservation is important. And like, you know, the Komodo dragons fight, I was like, maybe like our modern civilization is just helping us evade the fact that we're, you know, like the power struggle is what it's all about. Like it turns you into like an ev psych bullshit artist. Like I have nothing interesting to say except that I found this super interesting to think about.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. I was afraid you might come in with exactly the critiques I was just talking about of like, what is this bullshit? It's idealizing and it's anthropomorphizing. And
I found myself very defensive on behalf of the series when I was reading a bunch of articles about it afterwards. Daniel, our wonderful intern, had collected a whole bunch of fascinating stories about it. And there's all these negative reviews and critiques. It's so apolitical, these absurd narratives, like, you know, that this storytelling totally neglects the environmental apocalypse and humans' role in it. And I just thought all of those critics completely missed the fucking point. Like, nobody wants to be hectored at by Al Gore anymore. And watching this movie, I had more of a sense of the destruction and you know, havoc that human life is wreaking on the wild. I mean, in general, I take a very pragmatic view of it of like, well, the Earth's been around forever. Like I tend to think in geological time about the planet and think we probably will ruin it for ourselves and everybody else who lives here now. And then we'll all die. And then some other set of creatures will grow up in the next million or billion years.
And I hope David Attenborough is still around and able to talk
he'll
about
the he'll be the one guy who survives. He'll be like the valiant cockroach of our era.
I've said this before, but the idea that David Attenborough is mortal is just, it's unbearable to me. That is one person that he can't leave the earth. He loves it too much. Yeah, but so
that's your stoner insight.
In general, I'm drawn to that long view, and then just getting into the specifics of like these eagles fighting over a deer carcass in the Alps, or actually my very favorite piece of footage that I've seen so far was from the second episode about these Andean flamingos, or these flamingos drawn to these salt ponds in the northern Andes. Maybe they're freshwater, I don't remember, but doing this like mating dance where they literally just look like these incredible ballerinas. Like they hold their bodies completely parallel and do this kind of like waltzing back and forth while moving their black beaks and their pink heads rhythmically. Like it's just, I'm sorry, I have nothing to say. I sound like a fucking stoned idiot.
Believe me, when I watched the show, I watched it by myself, not even with my daughter, and I found myself doing my animal voice that I do when the two of us see unbearably cute things like bear cubs sliding down snowy slopes together. And by the time it was over, I was speaking only in the animal voice.
Oh my God, Steve, bring us some bracing truth. Do you hate this or something? Could like help me out.
Oh my God, are you kidding? No, this is. You know, one long suck on the vape pen. I mean, I had nothing but stoner thoughts too. I mean, the first is that vegetarianism is really not natural, right? Like, you know, I mean, what an talk about nature red in tooth and claw. I mean, it is just unremittingly like hostile and competitive environment. Also,
but there are love scenes too in here, though. I think yes. I should say
it's the albatross.
Oh yes, the albatross waiting for his monogamous mate to come back, and they do a little dance when she comes back too—a little dance of greeting.
Oh my God! I mean, it definitely makes you feel that whatever else is mysterious about human consciousness, it is absolutely continuous with animal consciousness. I mean, nothing has ever made me feel so confident that I was naturally derived, biologically rooted, evolutionarily produced creature, a result of nothing other than the blind processes of nature, which also produced all this panoply of incredible, creatures. I'm afraid I can't draw us out of the sort of stoner reverie that we're all having about it. I also don't care that much about, I mean, to whatever degree they have to craftily edit it in the service of anthropomorphism and narrative, like I kind of am willing to go along with it because it can't be that much. I mean, it can't be so much that they're radically falsifying what the encounters of these animals are like. I mean, you can't say to a group of snakes and a Komodo dragon, okay, back to one. You know,
a clapboard in front of the snake.
Yeah. That was the seagoing iguana, not the Komodo dragon.
Oh, that okay, is an unbelievable scene in Islands too. These little baby iguanas trying to get to the sea before an army of snakes capture them. I mean, it's absolutely, if you have a snake phobia, I don't at all, but it would be really, really rough to get through that scene.
I mean, you could convince me that he doesn't really want to give her the rose at the final ceremony on The Bachelor, and some producer told him to do it. I don't think you've talked those snakes into like, hey, have you ever tried, maybe if six of you tried to get one of those little baby lizards.
I didn't come to the Galapagos to make friends.
I didn't come to the planet to make friends. It's like the theme of the show.
I love it. I'll give you my giant stoner thought, which is that it made me think that consciousness is immanent in the universe. It's an implied property.
Yeah, I didn't get the key word in that. It's a what in the universe?
Immanent.
Oh, imminent.
No, immanent, right?
Yeah, I've never heard anyone say it immanent.
Daniel,
oh, really?
Break this fight. Let's battle like Komodo dragons over the pronunciation of this word.
It means that it's inherent in, even if not manifested in all instances, right? So in other words, even before there were conscious beings and even before there were human beings, there was this immanent property in the universe that made consciousness naturally a part of it. Like it's just a feature of all complex systems, but when they get complex and integrated systems, but when they get sufficiently complex and integrated, they're essentially conscious, right? And our brain is the most complex and integrated of all systems. Therefore, it's totally conscious, self-conscious, and rational. That was my stoner thought. That is what happens when I smoke too much pot.
I don't think I'm stoned enough to get that thought. So you're saying that it just made you feel like animals had feelings before we do? No, that's not what you're saying.
It just made me feel like all things are continuous with all things, man. And you're like fucking harshing on me now just for believing that.
According to Google, it's imminent.
Hot
damn.
But how is that not different from imminent?
That's the problem. That's why nobody ever says that word out loud.
Steve, exactly,
you're like the first person in recorded history to try saying that word out loud.
So maybe you just invented the pronunciation.
Do you want to just wrap there, Steve?
All right. Well, Ben apparently has had enough of this segment. All right. The show's Planet Earth, part two. And I found it streaming on Amazon, but there are various places to find it, including, I think, on BBC America. It is terrific. You should check it out. All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Stephen, my endorsement was inspired this week by one of the reviews of Planet Earth that we read in our prep. The New York Times review of the new Planet Earth series by Neil Genslinger contains the patently false statement, "You don't want to learn too much about how the film was made." And later on, he says, "Never mind the behind-the-scenes stuff. Just enjoy the view." So I happen to strongly disagree with this. I'm a huge fan of David Attenborough, as we discussed in the segment, and of the first Planet Earth series, which we own on DVD. And the DVD extras on that first Planet Earth series are fantastic, every one of them. There's a little making-of featurette called Planet Earth Diaries that goes along with each episode. And that used to be my daughter's favorite part to watch. Can we please stay up and watch the extras where you see these incredible cameramen? They're basically the world's greatest nature photographers. So they're all, you know, incredibly outdoorsy and tough, and they're risking their lives to get these beautiful shots and then doing talking head interviews to the camera about what was challenging about getting a certain shot or how long they had to wait for a certain animal to perform whatever behavior they were waiting for. And to me, it really made the show richer and much more interesting to see what happened behind the scenes, plus that you just get to know all these characters that are quite endearing, all these nature nuts and hot air balloonists and whatnot. So the Planet Earth Diaries are all available for the first series of Planet Earth on iTunes for $5. You can buy them as a package and watch them. Each one's about 10 or 15 minutes long, and they're just lots of fun from every point of view. Watch the Planet Earth Diary for the caves episode in the first series, in which they go into some of the world's deepest caves. They see amazing stalagmites and stalactites. They look at the creatures that live inside the caves. But the making of is just unbelievable, because there's a long segment where all of these cameramen are perched on top of a huge mountain of bat guano waiting for these cockroaches to come and do some, I don't know, kind of yearly migration or something. And they're basically talking to the camera about, this is my job right now, sitting on top of a giant pile of bat shit waiting for cockroaches to pour over me. It's unbelievable. It's good stuff. So Planet Earth Diaries on iTunes.
Oh, fantastic. All right, this week I'm just going to suck it up. I'm going to do it. Play down to my own worst self-fabricated
this
caricature.
This is your Gamelon, right?
This is my Gamelon. Ryan Adams is my Gamelon, Dana Stevens. But the truth is, greatness transcends even some people's desire to please others. And if you listen, I defy anyone to listen to Live at Carnegie Hall, which came out in 2015. He played two nights at Carnegie Hall, Ryan Adams, an acoustic guitar, a microphone, and however many adoring fans they packed in there. It's an extraordinary record. It really is a great record. It's just been playing on my car stereo on loop for a couple of weeks now. And the truth is, he uses all of what God gave him, right? Which is, you know, kind of affable brunette good looks, a nice Graham Parsons style croon, and pretty much, you know, the basic building blocks of songwriting as inherited from Bob Dylan. And I wouldn't say that he makes anything new, you know, if you had to make some argument as to historical importance, but fuck historical importance. Sometimes things are just intrinsically beautiful and beautifully crafted and well done. He's just a great songwriter. And personally, I think when you put him alone with a guitar, a lot of songs that don't land for me at all in the studio version. I mean, a good example being the song I Love You New York, which I think on the studio version is just a kind of a, you know, juiced up, hopped up dud. You know, when he does it alone with the guitar, it's just the most wonderful, sort of beautiful song. I mean, anyway, there are all these cliches about who he is and what he is. Throw them aside. The guy's just a tremendously gifted songwriter. Songs like Halloween, off Broadway, Come Pick Me Up, obviously, is a classic. I mean, this is just great, great songwriting. So highly recommended. Live at Carnegie Hall by Ryan Adams.
Oh, that was not a hard sell for me. I love Ryan Adams. We've talked about him before, and we've wanted to do one of his songs before. Maybe one day, Steve, you and I will do Come Pick Me Up together.
Julia, what do you have?
I actually want to re-endorse a collection of books that I have endorsed before, but they are the thing with which I have been most culturally entranced for the last couple of weeks, which is what I usually try to endorse, and they're such a great fit for Planet Earth if you're really digging that show. The books are by an author and artist called David Peters, and the three that we have are called Strange Creatures, Giants, and then Dinosaurs and Other Early Reptiles. And they have very detailed scale drawings of amazing creatures from all periods of the Earth, and then pretty detailed scientific descriptions of like what we know about these creatures and how they fit into different, you know, types and taxonomic understanding of how critters and creatures are related. And when I first looked at them with my kids, we would just look at the pictures and read the names. But now they're into reading them in order and really understanding the science. And it's a funny thing about reading cutting edge 1990s science in 2017 is that I kind of have been having to explain to my kids the scientific process as we read the books, because we'll read about what was known in the 90s. And I will point out that we don't know if that's still what the scientific understanding is. Reading these books and watching Planet Earth makes me want us to just like get a random paleontologist on the show and just grill them. Like, there's so many interesting assumptions that are made. I promise we won't actually do those, guys. But
what? We don't get a paleontologist?
Well, the peg for it is like a 20-year-old book that I'm reading with my children. It seems a little thin. But, you know, so one interesting example is we've been reading about the Stomatosuchus. The Stomatosuchus is a crocodile-like figure, prehistoric figure, that seemed to only have teeth on its top jaw, and the bottom jaw was kind of big and bulbous and humpback whaley. And the theory is that they would scoop up big clumps of water and then kind of surface and turn over on their backs, and all the water would drain out through the teeth, and they would catch whatever small critters were living in the body of water where they were. But then it says, fascinatingly, that only one skeleton of this creature was ever found in northern Africa around the turn of the 20th century. And then that skeleton was destroyed in a museum in Munich during Allied bombing, which like suddenly I'm having to like either lie or explain to my children. And my son has become obsessed with the idea of this lost single skeleton of the Stomatosuchus. And I'm like dying to find a paleontologist and be like, is this legit? Like, do we even know that they really found this, you know, before the 1940s skeleton? Like, how do we really know what we think we know? Like, the scientists that they were using in the 30s to make the assumptions they were making about the way the Stomatosuchus fed, do we still think that would be true even if we still had this skeleton? Does it mean anything that nobody's found more skeletons of this type of creature? Like, I've become obsessed with ways of paleontological knowing, basically, and I'm teaching my children to be obsessed with it as well, and we keep interrupting the book to, like, look things up. So anyway, these books are incredible. If you have kids who are nerdy and into biology at all, check them out on Amazon. See if you can find some old used copies. It's such a neat set of books. Because the books are both out of print, you can also download PDFs of a couple of them on his website. So again, his name is David Peters, and I highly, highly recommend these books.
All right. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. The Culture Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out an entire roster of shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. Our theme song is by Oscar-nominated composer Nick Britell, who was fucking robbed. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week.
Always love you, though, New York. New York.